Okay, so my name's Josh. I'm from the Sydney branch. I'm going to be chairing this session, which is titled Against Campism, Russia's Imperial Role in the World Today. Our speaker tonight is going to be Mick Armstrong. He's a member of the National Executive of Socialist Alternative. He'll speak for a while, and like all the other sessions, if people can hold their comments and questions and whatever till after his talk, we'll have plenty of time for discussion after that. And yes, I'll just have a few announcements at the end as well. Otherwise, I think we can get going. Take it away, Mick.
Okay. Well, the decisive role of the Russian bombing of Aleppo, and more broadly, the decisive role that the Russian forces have played in backing up the Assad regime in Syria and the destruction in a whole series of ways of the Syrian revolution poses quite sharply the question of coming to some understanding of the role of Russian imperialism in the world today. And this is clearly a controversial question on the left, where you have a range of opinions. You know, some people arguing that, you know, that Russia is not the imperialist power. Indeed, you know, there's people on the left argue that Russia is a neo-colonial nation exploited by imperialism, or that it's an anti-imperialist power, and that. Then there's other people who would not go that far, but would still say, well, Russia plays, you know, it's not imperialist, it plays a progressive role in standing up to the US, and so on, and that the extent that, you know, it's forced to go to war and that, it's essentially because it's being attacked, it's only defensive measures it takes to defend itself. And obviously there's no disputing the fact that America remains the number one imperial power in the world. You know, its economic and military might dwarfs all of its imperial rivals, whether that be Russia, China, or the, you know, the lesser imperial powers, Germany, and so on. And that neither Russia nor China come anywhere near to matching that power. But it's, you know, it's important to understand, you know, if we understand the world and imperialism more generally, that imperialism is not just about the actions of the number one imperial power in the world. You know, imperialism is capitalism taken to the world stage, where a whole series of states compete with each other, corporations compete with each other for profits, for markets, for political influence, and so on. You know, it's a whole series of jockeying position, and that's increasingly become the case over the last 20 years and so. You know, so you see, you know, the big powers and the still overwhelmingly most important power, the US, but a much weaker power relatively than it was when it was its height, you know, and so much dominated the world economy and the world military situation in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War, which it emerged so triumphant from. Today, there's a whole series of players on the world stage, you know, of imperial powers and lesser powers buffeting against each other, competing with each other, and competing with the US as well, and sometimes capable, you know, of having minor victories over the Americans. Okay. And, you know, sometimes these powers compete with each other, and at other times they have short-lived alliances. And that's, you know, we've seen that, you know, in Syria, where the Russians and the Americans had a long-term alliance there to crush the revolution, and that actually, you think, the scenario leading up to Trump's election, he wanted to continue that to establish a more deep-going alliance and so on. Now, the events over the last week or two have thrown that up in the air, but that's a issue I'll return to. Okay. Now, Russia, as an imperial power, has increasingly been asserting itself over the last 15 years. After reaching a low point in August 1998, when, you know, it defaulted on its $40 billion debt, where the value of the ruble collapsed in the space of 2 months and so on. And since that real low point for the Russian economy, it has managed to rebuild itself, revitalize itself economically, and consequently that's thrown through militarily. And it's managed to, militarily assert itself in a whole series of ways, in particular starting off with its brutal war against the Chechens and so on, where the bombing that destroyed the Chechen capital, Grozny, was very much a foretaste of what was going to happen to Aleppo. And subsequent of that, after their victory over the Chechens, the Russians had a series of military victories in Armenia, Moldavia, Georgia, the Crimea, the Ukraine, and now in Syria. Now, you've got to put this in a historical context, and I think it's worth, to understand what Putin people are doing today, it's worth looking at the longer history of Russian imperialism and how it's compared in an early period to Britain, subsequent to America. Russian imperialism has a long history, starting, back in the 18th century, the Tsarist Empire, with its base around Moscow, expanded westward into Europe, conquering the Baltic states, and Finland, Ukraine, a large chunk of Poland. Then it expanded eastward into Siberia, Mongolia, and whole parts of Central Asia. And then, in a series of brutal wars, it expanded southward into the Caucasus, fighting the local people like the Chechens, and also buffeting up against other regional empires, the Persian Empire or the Ottoman Turkish Empire, and so on. Now, the Tsarist Empire was never as strong economically as its rivals in Britain, France, and Germany, and so on, and that meant it was not capable, to be part of the scramble for Africa or to develop colonies in the Pacific and so on. Instead, it built a colonial empire by subjugating the peoples in the surrounding regions, and it literally subjugated hundreds and hundreds of different national and ethnic groups in the imperial empire. And, that very brutal, oppressive Tsarist Empire, in turn, was blown apart by the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917, which allowed, the independence of Finland, of Poland, and so on, and where a series of other nationalities, such as the Ukrainians, the Chechens, and so on, achieved their national rights within the framework of the new worker state. But with the counter-revolution in Russia at the end of the 1920s under Stalin, the empire was very rapidly and very brutally rebuilt in that. And so you see massive repression of a whole series of national minorities. The Chechens, the Volga Germans, the Tatars and so on, the whole of their populations, the whole of these nationalities are driven out of their homelands and confined to the gulags and that. Extermination policy. And then towards the end of the Second World War, the Russian army advanced into Central Europe, looting and pillaging as it went, subjugating and building up a big empire in Eastern in Europe and so on, which it ruled over for a whole historical period. In 1989, of course, that empire started to break down under pressure from the Cold War competition with the Americans in the West and so on. The Eastern European states gained their independence, and then over the next couple of years, Russia proper itself, the USSR, started to break apart, and that in so a whole series of peoples broke away, and you get all these new states formed in Armenia, Azerbaijan, Uzbekistan, the whole list of them gained their independence. And Russia was left with only about half of its original population. Its population went down from 248 million from 288 million. And its economic output fell 45%. Associated with this came a massive concentration of wealth in the hands of the oligarchs that took over. Within a couple of years, there were 26 billionaires in Russia. Nevertheless, even this reduced empire still included 21 republics of non-Russian people, and which covered 30% of the Russian territory, and numerous other smaller groups who remain nationally oppressed in Russia today. Now, as I mentioned, the economic low point of Russia came in 1998, following the collapse of the price for oil and gas. But then, with the recovery in the world market prices for hydrocarbons, the Russian economy started to grow again at a quite substantial rate. Between 1998 and 2007, the Russian economy grew an average of 6 to 7% a year. So quite a sustained period of economic recovery, and the Russians' debt was reduced substantially. But even though there were substantial attempts to broaden out the economy, hydrocarbon exports, oil and gas remained fundamental to the economy. Now, on the basis of this increased and improved economic situation, Russian began to reassert itself diplomatically, militarily, and so on. Much had to be done. In 1996, the Chechens had inflicted a decisive defeat, a humiliating defeat, on a Russian army which was made up with ill-paid, if paid at all, conscripts, who in the face of the resolute Chechen fighters basically threw in the towel, and the Chechens had a decisive victory. However, with Putin in charge, Russia recaptured the Chechen capital, Grozny, in 2000, and in the process of reducing it to rubble. Putin rebuilt the Russian military on a paid professional basis rather than relying on ill-paid conscripts. And this was a much better equipped army, using their new oil wealth. Parts under Putin, whole sections of the economy, which had previously been privatised, were now taken back under state control. And the state capital sector of the economy became quite substantial. And this is particularly true in the hydrocarbon sector, where the gas monopolies and so on are parastatal institutions. State control or, connected economies control a big chunk of the companies listed on the Russian Stock Exchange, a large section of the banking industry, pretty much all the media and so on is under state control. And this state capital sector is crucial for the Russian economy and that. Now, in 2007, with the decline in oil and gas prices, that was an important setback for the Russian economy. But they managed to weather this continued to stabilise the situation. It has to be said still, it gets some sense of proportion, that still, even at the height of the recovery in 2007, Russia's economic output was still only about 8% of US output, and its military spending about 4 to 5% of what the Americans spent. But and compared to other powers, though, other middling powers, Russia still had the decisive advantage in militarily at being the second most important nuclear armed power. By 2012, on purchasing power prices, the Russian economy was about level with Germany. So the Russian ruling class had substantially overcome the economic crisis of the 1990s. And it's important to see, in no sense is Russia some sort of semi-colonial country, as some on the left would argue. The economy is not dominated by rival imperialist powers. Russian enterprises were not substantially brought up by foreign companies, as happened in some Eastern European states, such as the Czech Republic or Hungary. And moreover now, Russian companies have very substantial, massive investments overseas. The gains of this economic recovery flowed overwhelmingly to a tiny minority of billionaires at the top of society, most of whom are closely associated with Putin. According to Credit Suisse, there are now 110 billionaires in Russia who own 35% of the total wealth, and the OECD ranks Russia as one of the most, you know, having one of the highest levels of income disparities in the world. To maintain this situation, Russian imperialism and the Russian ruling class cannot allow even the sort of very limited, you know, bourgeois democracy that exists in its imperial rivals in the West, in Japan, and so on. Actually, in order to regalvanize the Russian economy, direct its state-owned industries and so on, they need authoritarian rule to centrally direct a managed economy. And combined with that, they need authoritarian rule like a Putin to hold the mass of population in check. And, you know, so in Russia, there's a parliament, but, you know, it's a pseudo-parliament. All the parties in the parliament are subservient to Putin. Now, as I said, under Putin, the Russian Empire was gradually rebuilt. Russia could not prevent a number of republics breaking away in 1998. But since then, it has used a combination of economic repression, military force, the fomenting of internal rebellions and dissent in a whole series of the neighbouring countries to reassert its power and influence. You know, as I mentioned, the case of the Chechens was the first test in this strategy. Before Putin came to power in 1994, Yeltsin had tried this when he besieged the Chechen capital, Grozny, in the largest artillery barrage since the Second World War. You know, Grozny was reduced to rubble with 2,000 shells an hour landing on Grozny. The Russians then recaptured the city briefly, then the Chechens regained it, then Putin eventually restored Russian control and devastating the place. And since then, you know, Russian forces have been involved, you know, in supporting various wars in the region between Armenia and Azerbaijan, in Gestishia versus Novosetia and so on. It subsequently formed an alliance with China in the Shanghai Cooperation Pact, which in turn alarmed the US. In Europe, Russia has used its oil and gas supplies, and particularly the gas, for its own economic and political leverage. The technical term for this, I think, is blackmail. In January 2006, it cut off the gas supplies flowing to the Ukraine, which was where the pipeline went through to Germany and so on, and that to discipline the Ukrainians, but also to send a message to the Western Europeans who were increasingly dependent on Russian gas supplies that they should watch their P's and Q's in Ukraine and the Russian borderlands. Russia has, on a number of occasions, employed so-called volunteers, usually irregular army soldiers, supposedly on vacation, to intervene in a series of regional conflicts. For example, in Moldova, where they backed a pro-Russian breakaway state. And the Russian advances, if you like, came to a head in 2005, when they humiliated the US in their short-lived war with Georgia and that. But much more important than Georgia for Russia was the Ukraine. Now, it's easily the largest of the former Soviet republics with 45 million people and that, and very important for Russian economic purposes, but for strategic purposes as well. The Russians could not hope to totally dominate in the Ukraine or incorporate it back into Russia, but they could at least hope for a balance of power, or, you know, sort of a power-sharing arrangement there. And in that regard, then, the overthrow by the Maidan movement of the pro-Russian president alarmed them, And their response to that, of course, was to whip up discontent amongst the minority of Russian speakers in the eastern part of Ukraine, and back the pro-Russian guerrilla forces there, sending in Russian tanks and so on, who made mincemeat of the Ukrainian army. And then. To really thumb their nose at the Ukrainians, they seized the Crimea off Ukraine, which was vital for Russian strategic interests. Is their port and their access to the Black Sea. The EU subsequently and the US subsequently applied sanctions to Russia over their seizure of Crimea. But they would not seriously back up the Ukrainian government, whose forces were no match for Russian tanks and so on. So the West didn't intervene militarily in the Ukraine to any serious extent, and nor were they prepared to supply the sort of armaments the Ukrainians would have needed to stand up to the Russians. And that was an important victory for Putin, not just in relation to the Ukraine, but in relation to places like Latvia, Estonia, and so on, because it was a signal to the other border states, well, Putin is prepared to push the envelope, and the West will not be guaranteed at all to come to your rescue, and so on, and that. Okay, well, let me move on to Syria. Syria was, a much more bold measure by Putin than his activities on the borderlands and that. Syria had never been part of the Warsaw Pact, doesn't neighbour Russia and so on, though it was one of the few remaining, allies, of the Russians going back to the Cold War era, and where the Russians maintained an important naval base. And from the beginning of the Syrian revolution, the Russians backed the Assad regime. Not because I think they had any great, sympathy for Assad as such, but for the fear that if Assad fell and that they'd lose all their influence, or the limited influence they still had in the important Middle East, the oil-rich region it was. And, of course, for concern to maintain their important Mediterranean naval base. Over the last 2 years, the Russians have substantially ramped up their military intervention into the Ukraine, and that's been decisive in turning around the whole fighting there. You think back 18 months or so, it seemed that the Assad regime was very much on its last legs. Could it survive? The massive Russian bombing campaign, its flow of materials to back up the Assad forces, and also the role of Russian forces on the ground in stiffening and training the various Shiite militias. Because you've got to remember, the Syrian army essentially collapsed. It's not the Syrian army that does most of the fighting on the ground. It's all the various Shiite militias brought in by the Iranians from Afghanistan and so on, the sectarian Shiite militias recruited inside Syria itself. And they were somewhat ramshackle outfits, but the Russian military advisors have turned them into moderately efficient fighting forces, whereas the normal Syrian troops basically won't fight in that. And and the end point and the outcome of this, of course, was symbolised in the destruction of Aleppo. Okay. The American response to this under Obama was one level attempt to push back against this and to try to strengthen NATO, expand NATO further into Eastern Europe and so on. Draw a line and that. Well, not just draw a line, actually, they wanted to penetrate further, but the whole series of failures, that they'd failed in Georgia, when Georgia wanted to go into the EU or join NATO and the Russians intervened and stopped that and so on. And the American pushback partly hasn't been all that successful because, you know, of the weakening and the setbacks America had suffered, you know, in the drawn-out crisis, the defeats that it suffered in Iraq and Afghanistan and so on, had weakened the American positions. And thus, that resulted in the, you know, important factor in the fact that Ukraine became a standoff. The election of Trump opened up the possibility, though, of a new ball game. You know, and reflected in, you know, his long-standing argument for a rapprochement with Putin. And it has to be said there was a rational core to Trump's argument for this alliance. It was not just the mutual attraction of two authoritarian dictators and that. Trump, you know, argued that Russia was not the main threat to the US on the world stage, not the main economic threat and so on, that China was the threat. And, you know, he, in that context, he was looking to cut a deal with Russia, get, you know, rid of the sanctions imposed on Russia over Crimea and so on. And this would, you know, under his deal, you know, he was foreshadowing, you know, Russia would be allowed to reassert itself in its borderlands and have been given a certain space in the Middle East. And that, and, you know, that, you know, the Trump and Putin would cooperate together in the war against ISIS. Well, they've already been cooperating, you know, but that'd be stepped up. Trump hoped that such a deal would pull Russia away from any alliance with China, you know, would just, you know, isolate it as sort of this regional power in its borderlands and so on, but no particular problem for America on the world stage. And this would give, you know, America greater space for a more aggressive policy, both economically and diplomatically and militarily, against China. Now, the events over the last week, of course, you know, have thrown all this up in the air, and that, and I think now we've got to say, you know, what Trump will do, you know, being such an erratic figure anyhow, you know, we don't know for sure. And it could take weeks, if not months, for the position to start to clarify. But on the other hand, despite all the heightened rhetoric and that, you know, I don't think we should say the deal's off the table at all. You know, the fact that the, you know, before they, you know, Trump attacks, you know, the airbase, but he warns the Russian in advance. So this is, you know, he goes out of his way to warn them and that. And now, you know, like, you know, you can think of all sorts of reasons why Trump did what he did to, you know, assert himself as the great power. Well, now he's dropped the other bomb on Afghanistan, which doesn't worry the Russians. They think it's fine. And that is taking out ISIS. So, you know, we don't know where it'll go. But, you know, there's a logic to it that, the quite clearly the main rival of the US is China. And so, in that context, while we can't exactly predict where things will go, I think, you know, as I said, I don't think the deal's off the table. And ideal, I think it would be truly ironic for those people on the left that somehow think Russia's progressive or somehow is a bastion against the US, that the two, you know, great authoritarians stitch up a deal, you know, which would tell you something about the real nature of world imperial politics today. I'll leave it there.